everybody. It's Trevin McGee again on Friday, hoping that yours is a great one, because ours definitely is. I'm here with Eric Moline and Trey Hawk, also of Scene Stealers, and we are here to talk about three movies today. We've got the newest addition to the Bourne legacy, the Bourne film saga. Trey's going to talk about Ruby Sparks, a little movie with Paul Dano. And Eric, you've got The Campaign with Zach Galifianakis, Will Ferrell, and Jason Sudeikis. So why don't we start with that one? I'd love to hear more about the Campaign.
Okay, so The Campaign is directed by Jay Roach, who made his name on the Austin Powers movies and then had a big breakthrough hit with Meet the Parents, and lately he's been doing a lot of political stuff. He did the movie Recount, which I believe was an HBO film, and then he did recently Game Change, which was the Sarah Palin movie with Julianne Moore. And now he's doing more political humor, following up his last theatrical movie, Dinner for Schmucks, with The Campaign. And you could maybe tell from the falling of my voice there on the end. There's not a lot of good things to say about this movie. It is really about as lazy as political satires can get.
Okay. Go on.
Okay. So I mean, we don't necessarily expect a sharp level of satire from Adam McKay, who's the producer, who's worked with Ferrell on a lot of his biggest movies, Talladega Nights and Anchorman and things like that. But here's the thing. There's so much opportunity in this film. Basically, the premise is these two Republican candidates running for a House seat will do anything to one-up each other. And so the movie rises and falls on a series of one-upping each other kind of political tactics that are completely hollow and baseless. And the best thing about the film is more of a cumulative effect. There is no talk in the entire film about actual policy or issues. Not one moment. So the best thing about it is that after 85 minutes, you get the complete picture that, American politics has nothing to do with actually wanting to do anything good for people or engage with actual issues of the day, and everything to do with big, big platitudes. So Will Ferrell's speech, or his slogan, is America, Jesus, Freedom. And Galifianakis' character slogan is, it's a mess. And which is pretty funny. Here's the deal. Galifianakis is playing another effeminate weirdo with a fanny pack, right? So he's equal parts hangover, equal parts due date, and also equal parts Seth Galifianakis, if you're familiar with his stand-up routine.
Yeah, I was going to ask, because the voice sounds like Seth from his comedy stuff.
Yeah, and Will Ferrell is doing a different version, very rooted in the reality of his George W. Bush impression. This is another loud, overconfident kind of buffoon type character, a similar thing that we get from him. So what I'm trying to say is that neither actor is really stretching, and that's not necessarily a bad thing because they do these characters really well, but when there's no script to prop them up and they've got to improvise, the film feels like an outline for a sketch, not for a feature-length film. And they do everything in their power to make it as funny as possible, but there's a desperate amount of uncomfortable swearing in this movie. Like, this is definitely a rated-R movie, and when you know that they're resorting to kids swearing, it's like you realize, wow, they're just really trying to pull anything out here.
I can't remember what.
I was going to say, he's not funny once, and his character as being the campaign manager to Will Ferrell, he has absolutely nothing to do in the film at all. It's almost a waste that he's in the movie because we know that he can be funnier. And then there's all these other throwaway characters like John Lithgow and Dan Aykroyd called the Mach Brothers, who are obviously, you know, like the Koch brothers in Wichita, that evil pair of evildoers. But it's just so toothless. It's really not intelligent at all. And even though I wasn't expecting a high level of satire from you know, the people involved in this movie, they're all smarter than this. And it feels like something they threw together at the last minute to get out before the election and show everybody something that we already know, which is that elections have gone too far and they push too many buttons with nothing behind them, and they're willing to do anything to make or break their candidate. And it doesn't hold up for 85 minutes. It's fairly disappointing.
All right. So what's I was trying to see what else the writers have done on this, and I don't really see much of anything. At least, I mean, like, we've got some Eastbound and Down credits, stuff like that, but nothing really big that stands out.
I'd be surprised if the writers had that much to do with the movie. I think that, like I said, it seems like they started the film with the basics of a script, like an outline. Maybe they came up with funny ideas like, oh, Will Ferrell punches a baby, and then Zach Galifianakis responds by doing this ridiculous thing, and Ferrell responds by doing this ridiculous thing. And that in and of itself would have made a really funny sketch.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's it.
All right. So what's your...
This is a minor rock this down.
Minor rock this down?
Yeah, I mean, I did laugh. There are some... I mean, these are funny comedians, you know, and
is
there
another
are
horrible boxes?
Themselves.
Yeah, is this another horrible boxes situation where you've got a pretty mediocre or less than mediocre movie that's elevated by some gifted improvisational comedy? Is that what we're in store for here?
I think even Horrible Bosses had a better script than this movie.
Okay.
that's all I can say. I mean, it's you know, you know if you're going to this movie, know what to expect. Set your sights very low, and you might have a good time. But it's just really, like I said, toothless. It's something you may want to watch on cable if it's free later on. But there's nothing in it that you don't already know, and nothing in it that's going to make you laugh really hard.
Stream it on Netflix when you're done watching Thor for the seventh time?
No, I'm saying wait for Comedy Central on cable between commercials.
Right. Yeah. That's
okay.
A good idea.
Nice.
It's that disappointing.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
That makes sense to me.
All right. Yeah.
Well, Dre, how about we go from comedy to your little indie, the indie movie of the week. How was Ruby Sparks?
It was pretty solid. I went in with, I want to say, moderate to low expectations. I don't avoid trailers the way that Eric will avoid trailers. And I knew from the get-go, because the trailer shows that it's such, but that this was a Pygmalion comedy, which, just to very briefly explain, a Pygmalion comedy, Pygmalion was a character from Ovid, he was a man of Cyprus, was upset with the women, so he was a sculptor, and he carves his own female form. And Venus blesses him and makes the woman real. So Pygmalion comedies have been things like My Fair Lady is probably the most famous, although Pretty Woman is one, even something like Weird Science.
Right.
So the idea is that you craft and mold your counterpart, your, you know, the woman that you are involved with. And the thing about these films is what I always find most interesting, and even in the original Pygmalion myth, is something that's always skipped over, and that is once the woman is created and made real, well, shit, what happens then?
Right.
And in the Pygmalion myth, you know, it's once the woman's real, it's two more lines and we're already off to their child, their offspring, years and years later. And it's kind of the same way, like with Pretty Woman, he drives back in the car and they go off. So there's always this missing portion, which to me is the most fascinating part of it. It's like, okay, once you've made the partner that you want, what happens then? And that's really what Zoe Kazan, who plays Ruby Sparks but also was the screenwriter,
mm-hmm.
that's where she focuses. And the first act is basically the creation of Ruby. And, you know, we've got Paul Dano playing Calvin, who is this introverted writer, and he has gotten out of a bad relationship, hasn't dated in a year or so for some indeterminate amount of time. But he is, like Pygmalion, dissatisfied with the women around him.
Mm-hmm.
And so as part of a kind of a psychological assignment given to him by his psychiatrist, he has to start describing a person who would like his dog. And he has a dog that he himself finds unlovable. And so he has to describe somebody who might like his dog for all of its flaws and whatnot. And so he begins writing, and it becomes this, you know, sort of gush of description that becomes Ruby. So Ruby exists in the first act, and then once she exists, the rest of the film is all about their relationship together. So once you get the woman you want, the perfect woman that you have crafted out of your own imagination, what happens then? And so, I found this whole story really compelling because it kind of plays with a couple of fundamental questions that rise up out of a lot of the twee films, you know, where you get these, you know, sort of frenetic girlfriends that are messy, but exactly what the guy needs, and therefore totally fake, just mythic creations out of some dude's head. And then you also get this sort of antagonism between what we would like our partner to do or how we would like our partner to behave because it would be more cohesive or easier, and how they really behave, which we then have right. to kind of resolve, you know, and compromise and you know, understand that, well, it happens the other way too. Sometimes we behave in ways that make things more difficult for those we're involved with as well.
So which
and
one is she?
That it's a compromise on their end also.
So is she both of those, or is she one of those, or?
No, she, yeah, no, they it's all of those questions are in play. Yeah, everything's in play. And I think the thing that really succeeds about this film is that all of that is on the table and you're able to ponder throughout the film. And yet it doesn't feel just like a discussion about those topics. It
right.
is not just an academic work about dissecting the, you know, frenetic dream world, the you know, the pixie dream girl. It's not just about, you know, smashing that man, you know, because you could decide, oh, I'm going to write a screenplay where I want to destroy the myth of the pixie dream girl.
Right.
And it would feel academic, and this doesn't. It still feels like a story about these two characters and their interaction. Paul Dano and Zoe Kazan are both compelling in their roles. So, you know, and I think that's where it succeeds. It succeeds is that it's not just a discussion. It's an actual film with real and developed characters that feels satisfying. There are a couple of things that, you know, moments, certain things where, where it doesn't quite work, but those are typically pretty minor. And I know that there are going to be some people out there that will, I know there could be a discussion over the satisfactory nature of the ending. Like how satisfying it is, like whether it's a good ending or a bad ending. But the nice thing about the ending is it does leave it open enough to where you can kind of go, oh, okay, you know, I can see that we could go a couple of different ways with this. But there, you know, I think there are others that could argue that, you know, maybe it's even too resolved. So there's, you know, there are definitely some flaws. Like, you can kind of see the couple of thoughts that inspired the creation of this story without those feeling, without it feeling overly structured and clunky. It still feels, you know, the relationship still feels really vibrant and interesting.
Cool. You know, if I were going to write a movie that sort of took down the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, I would just write a sequel to Elizabethtown, where Orlando Bloom wakes up and has a psychotic episode and just murders Kirsten Dunst, and then proceeds to like the Pixie Dream Girls from other movies like 500 Days of Summer, and he's just a serial murderer for Pixie Dream Girls.
You know what? I don't want to get into the big Manic Pixie Dream Girl argument, but I liked Elizabethtown. I've only seen it once. I realized it was deeply flawed, but I kind of love that about it. And I don't think that Zooey Deschanel fits the Manic Pixie Dream Girl mold as much as you do in 500 Days of Summer.
Well, I totally do.
No.
Well, then what was his Yes Man that she was in also? Fits it in that.
She totally fits it in multiple movies. That her entire TV show is that too. It'd also be fun if in this script I'll never write that would never happen if Orlando Bloom made it into Garden State and killed Natalie Portman with a machine gun.
I would appreciate getting rid of that character.
Yeah, just a parade. Not the real Natalie Portman. Fictional character.
And Orlando Bloom may appreciate you throwing him a bone.
Yeah, he hasn't really worked since. Well, he's got this new movie out called Good Doctor that looks like we'll be seeing it on Lifetime sometime soon. But
okay.
Give
him another year or two and you might be able to snatch him up cheap.
That's true.
As part of the template of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, I believe she is supposed to be a positive influence and cure her male counterpart for the better. And she does not do that.
You're thinking of Magic Black Man. That's what Magic Black Man does. Manic Pixie Dream Girl is just a quirky little weird thing that makes the guy fall in love with her and then leaves unexpectedly and comes back.
Anxious and doesn't know how to have fun, and that's what's holding him back, you know. And then all of a sudden this messy, problem-ridden, you know, 20-something stuck in a teenage world.
Not necessarily 20-something. I mean, Will Ferrell's in his 40s when he meets Maggie Gyllenhaal in Stranger Than Fiction, and she's totally a Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Right, but she's a 20-something.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Manic Pixie Dream Girl has to be a 20-something. They're always, you know,
they're always too old
to be acting the way they are. So they're always in their 20s, should hold a job, but still are kind of like, oh, well, I'm just traveling the world and doing whatever. And then they come in and disrupt the life of the stuffy dude just enough to make his life better and wonderful and make them love life and learn how to love.
Yep.
And that's what a Manic Pixie Dream Girl comes. They're always cute, they're always funny, they're always just messy enough.
And that's not what happens in 500 Days of Summer, and she's a real jerk, and she's just like that because of the way she is, and that's, so there you go, end of that.
I'm not going to entertain that debate anymore. Does Ruby Sparks do that, though? Is she a magic little messy lady that comes out of nowhere and makes Paul Dano realize that, hey, maybe if I got
they play with it.
That,
I mean, they're
I
playing, they're,
like
she's, yeah, Zoe Kazan is definitely playing with the convention. And she basically muddies the water.
Okay.
In a pretty fun way. It's compelling. The choices that are made are compelling. No one, even at the end of this film, no one is genuinely fixed.
Okay.
And I thought that was really great.
Okay, so what's your rock fist on this?
You know, I'm kind of between a minor and a solid, but I'll give it the higher one. I'll go solid rock fist up. I think some people may have a problem with the ending. I do think that there are a couple of moments that might lower it for others.
Uh-huh.
But for me, it was pretty satisfying the whole way through.
All right. Well, good. Does Orlando Bloom show up and kill her with a machine gun?
No, he doesn't, but he doesn't need
okay.
to.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
No, that he's still using his quiver.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah, he's using his shield surfboard.
Right. That still counts as one.
Yeah, never forget. That is Peter Jackson's Ewok moment.
Yeah.
Nice.
All right. Well, then the last movie to discuss is the one I saw, which was the latest Bourne movie, Bourne Legacy. The interesting story behind the Bourne Legacy before I get into it. The third Bourne movie, Bourne Ultimatum, is supposed to be the last one. All three of the films were written by Tony Gilroy, who has directed Michael Clayton, and he's written several scripts throughout his career, including Michael Clayton and many others.
Oscar-nominated director.
When the studio actually really considered making a fourth Bourne movie, the then-director, Paul Greengrass, said, no, I'm not going to be attached to do another one of these. He even at the time joked that it should be called the Bourne Redundancy. Matt Damon was kind of on the fence, you know, he'd been Jason Bourne for three movies, wasn't sure. He ultimately decided to go with Greengrass, who had directed him before and directed him in Green Zone and has kind of been a regular collaborator with Damon for the last decade. So he sided with the guy he knew.
Apparently, Trevor, that the grass isn't always greener.
Wow.
I'm going to send Orlando Bloom after you, Nick. not even losing the director and star of a franchise is enough to end a franchise anymore. And the studio decided that they were going to continue on with the Bourne series. And so what they decided to do is they gave it to Mr. Tony Gilroy, the writer. So now he directs it. And he wrote this, and rather than try and pick up where the last movie left off, it goes in a different direction. It is a big departure from anything remotely connected to the Ludlum books. This movie kind of expands what was going on at the time Jason Bourne was figuring out who he was and going through Treadstone and Blackbriar and Just Leave Me Alone and everything that happens to him over three movies. And the idea is that there were not just one program, there were multiple programs that used behavior modification and brainwashing to train soldiers into these perfect killing machines. And it focuses on a new guy. Jeremy Renner is a new operative. His name is Aaron Cross. And he's part of a completely different outfit. Jeremy Renner is contractually obligated to be in every movie now.
Yeah.
So he was happy to step up in this. And I won't get into much of the plot because it is basically a chase movie. It's a bit of a revenge movie, but mostly it's just kind of a big chase, a big kind of journey from one end to the other. And my biggest disappointment with it, there are a few little plot holes or plot
know, bits that you kind of have to look past or else it will derail the movie completely. But my biggest complaint was, you know, I was actually excited to hear that a new director was getting a hold of it. Greengrass is really known for a lot of the hyperkinetic action scenes, like rapid fire editing and handheld camera work from the last few Bourne movies. And that kind of became, I don't know if he popularized it, but it definitely became more popular right around the time he was doing it too, in action movies. And
I would say he popularized it. You can say that.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that definitely became, you know, Doug Liman directed the first Bourne movie, and it was a little like that. But when Greengrass got a hold of it, it really became the standard for the last two Bourne movies, especially. And it got exhausting, and especially when it became sort of a common practice in action movies. I mean, you can even see remnants of that in Batman Begins. I mean, there are plenty of action movies that incorporate that. And as a moviegoer, I'm just kind of sick of it. I'm burned out on it. So I was excited to know that a new director was getting a hold of it, and I wanted to see what he would do with it. Unfortunately, it's more of the same. More of the same, you know, hyperactive, shaky cam. You have chase sequences that are overdone and just kind of difficult to follow. There are a few times when he interjects some of his own style in, and those work really well. There's a great sequence about a third of the way into the movie where the camera follows Renner's character as he goes outside a building, scales the side of the building, goes through an upstairs window, goes down the stairs, and shoots an attacker. And it all happens over the span of about 30 seconds. It's a really cool follow shot that I'm sure that computers helped stitch those scenes together. You can almost, there's a pretty clear edit point. But it was still new enough and easy enough to follow that I really liked it. And there are a couple more scenes like that. There's a sequence that's in the trailers that shows him in a bit of a chase on top of a roof. That works really well also. So you know, I really wanted to see more of that. I wanted this movie to be a departure. I can understand how he would want to keep the same tone and style from the previous three movies, just because, you know, it's a brand and it's something that people recognize. But I really did want to see him do more. Him, you know, being Gilroy, I did want to see him do more with this franchise. Beyond that, you know, Renner's solid. There is a really smart thing that I don't want to spoil, but the motivation for the chase, the reason that Renner and his Rachel Weisz is this doctor named Marta that is also part of the program that gets kind of 86. They end up kind of teaming up and making a run for get to the other side of the world. And the reason for that, the motivation for that, works really well. And it actually incorporates, from all things, elements from, you know, Flowers for Algernon into the movie, which I thought was totally different and a fascinating way to take it. But overall, you know, I liked it enough. It does enough right with the performances and some of the chances that, you know, I can't give it a really negative review. I can't give it a really positive review. I don't believe in this. You know, I gotta say I was just kind of let down by it, so, you know, a minor rock fist down. I wanted to really like it, which is disappointing, but it's another one where, like, if you caught it on, I think it would play better on a small screen. I think it would play better on a television. Like, if you caught it on HBO or if you waited till it was on Netflix streaming or something, you probably wouldn't miss much. Renner gives another solid performance, you know, but he doesn't have as much to work with. His character, you know, to Tony Gilroy's credit, his character is complicated. His character is complex, and still likable.
So that's what I was going to ask you. The most important thing for me is that the only Bourne movie that really grabbed me and made me give a shit was the first one. And
yeah.
So what I want to know about this Gilroy script is, is there any character development, or is it just a series of mousetraps and chase like the last two?
No, there's a decent amount of character motivation, and he spends the first part of the movie is especially slow. You just kind of get a feel for who the characters are and what's going on. You know, for an action movie,
That's bold.
Yeah. I mean, there's not a lot. And in fact, like, Aaron Cross as a operative doesn't even fight anybody until about 45 minutes into the movie, I'd say.
Wow. Crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, there's not a lot. I mean, there's not a lot of action at the first part of the movie, and especially like hand-to-hand type stuff, like the franchise is known for, doesn't show up until significantly later. Yeah, you know, I have to give him a pretty you know tepid minor Rock Fist Down. Rachel Weisz doesn't have anything to do, and she's kind of this little helpless damsel in distress for most of the movie, which is frustrating to watch. You know, they managed, maybe some of the footage was shot when Greengrass was still involved, you know. Maybe some new stuff was filmed, but it does do a really good job of telling its own story, but still keeping it in that universe and kind of checking in with the whereabouts and what's going on with the other characters. Timeline-wise, it takes place right towards the end of Bourne Ultimatum when he's in New York and Pamela Andy's character is going to blow the lid off the whole Treadstone thing. Edward Norton again doesn't have much to do. I mean, really, it's you know a minor Rock Fist Down serves it well.
I've got a question.
But it just doesn't really have anything to do. Yeah, what's up?
So, all right, this is the fourth in the series. You know, we've had a fourth Die Hard. It sounds like we're going to get another one. We've had a fourth Indiana Jones movie. And here is a question. Indiana Jones doesn't quite fit this, but the way they've treated Indiana Jones, it fits well.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a distinction between film series that are genuinely serial.
Right.
Such as like a James Bond, where it's built into it that it's like this guy is a secret agent and he goes on missions. So we can have as many of these missions as we need. It's not a sequel, it's a serial.
Right.
Now, with situations like Die Hard, and it this one seems to be doing in some ways the same thing. In Die Hard, we have a fallible character who can totally bleed and half the time wins out of luck more than his own skills, though those do come into play at times.
Yeah, in the first three. In the fourth one, he uses the comic.
Well, no, I wouldn't
character.
Even say in the first three. In the first one,
After
that, the situations that he finds himself in become more and more ludicrous until we get to the fourth one, when he is impervious to bullets.
Crashing helicopters. Crashing planes and helicopters and shooting himself to kill the bad guy.
And that's what seems the same way with, you know, with Indiana Jones. And it appears from the trailers that they have with this newest Bourne film, that they have pushed it so far you're constantly having to backtrack to kind of line up all the dots so they sort of make sense. And I guess what I'm saying is that why, you know, I know they want to cash in on a franchise, and I know that so many of these studios are just, you know, cash-strapped or want to appear to be cash-strapped so that they can continue making money and getting write-offs. But it's frustrating to me. Why don't they take this talented group of people and make something new and awesome that they're all excited about? I get really frustrated. But is this the same scenario? Have they pushed it too far?
No. I mean, it's more of a lateral move or an expansion on the universe. Like, because it's not the same character, they're not stretching him to new and unbelievable places. This movie does incorporate something. I mean, like, I wouldn't call it fantastical, but his character is enhanced in a way.
Right.
And it's explained in the movie, and I don't really want to spoil it because it's a big part of it. But he's not. He has a biological advantage that Jason Bourne didn't. So the idea just not really. No, because
here, let's just put the spoiler dome down. Is it aliens?
Yeah, it's aliens. It turns out that the Aztecs are aliens. No, I mean we
nice.
Can go ahead. We can go ahead and spoil it. If you're gonna go see it, go ahead and tune out right now because I'm gonna go ahead and spoil it. The gist is that there are several different special operations units that are sort of variations of the Bourne, the Treadstone initiative, and basically what that means is like people are kind of taking what they started and doing different things with it. And the one that Aaron Cross is a part of, they have all been infected with this virus. They have to take these pills. There's a green one and a blue one. And what it does is it works like a virus in the sense that it infects cells and it spreads throughout the body. The one set of pills, the green ones, increase mitochondrial production by like 1.5%. I think Rachel Weisz says at one point. And what that means is it allows him to, you know, he can run longer, he can run harder longer, he can, you know, like it there's benefits to his muscle, mass and durability, things like that. The blue one actually is supposed to be a big breakthrough because it affects cognitive functionality and makes him smarter, makes the person smarter and their mind more elastic. This is really important. And when I mentioned the Flowers for Algernon thing earlier, like you can get virus out on either of those pills. So what they do is they infect you with a virus and your body fights it off. But when it's done, the effects of the pills are basically permanent. So the pills are like a shorthand version of it. But if you wanted to wean off the pills, you would you'd be infected with the virus and then fight it off. And then once your body has fought it off, you've got the benefits of the medicine forever. And so he's freaking out because he needs to get his medicine, basically. And he gets
right.
to her because he remembers that she helped him out, and they're talking. And what he ends up revealing is that he needs the blue pills because before all this, before this operation, before he became a special agent and everything, he was borderline mentally handicapped. An army recruiter basically signed him up without him really knowing what was going on. He was in a state home. And
gotcha.
He goes over, his platoon is, you know, on the books, he's dead. His real name's Ken Kitson, and on the books, he's dead. They incorporate him into the plan to see just how well this new treatment battery will affect people of normal intelligence, higher intelligence, lower intelligence. And it turns out, you know, it makes him very intelligent, gives him a, you know, a tactical advantage. He's a fully, like, realized, capable operative. And it's really important to him that he, you know, not lose that and go back to the way that he was. And the scenes that deal with that, they do that in a really interesting way between kind of flashbacks between two different characters that were involved at the time, one being Renner's character and the other being Ed Norton's character. And it's chilling, you know, it's kind of disturbing, and it gets the job done dramatically. At least for me, it did. The other thing that it does really well is, I mean, there's Ed Norton's character isn't just a bad guy who wants everybody dead like all the other Bourne movies, like there's just some crooked bureaucrat that's, you know, the face of the plan, and then as soon as the plan goes belly up, he starts shooting people in broom closets and things like that. He's like a genuinely conflicted person who's trying to sort this out, but at the same time, like, doesn't really think what he's doing is right necessarily. And so that was a bonus for it. But, you know, it didn't do enough of that kind of stuff to redeem itself in the ways that it was just kind of boring and repetitive and more of what we'd seen before. So, you know.
So final word, Minor Rock Fist down.
Yeah. And again, you know, it doesn't turn him into a comic book character. It doesn't make him a superhero. It just kind of expands the universe laterally. It's not a jump forward. It's just kind of a step to the side. So.
Gotcha.
Well, the next couple weeks are pretty hit and miss, so I don't even know, as far as movies go and everything, what we're going to be up to, but it doesn't sound like there's much to get excited about this week either.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Well, I mean, Ruby Sparks, you know, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, I really
solid,
think the
solid
the worst,
is the
like,
best
I mean,
Ruby, the most
what?
Solid Ruby out of all of us.
Right.
Yeah. And I really feel like even if you don't, you know, even if you didn't appreciate it or like it as much as I did, I would be surprised if you walk out of the theater genuinely disappointed.
Yeah, well, that's good enough for me.
Just as long as you can avoid genuine disappointment, that's all
as
you
long
want.
As, pretty much, yeah. I'm. That's the one thing I look for when I go into a movie is to not just be genuinely heartbroken when I leave.
One of the things I look for is to avoid seeing Dan Aykroyd, and I didn't do that in the campaign, so.
Oh, he's
nice.
He's in the campaign? That's too bad.
Yeah, Dan Aykroyd and John Lithgow as the Mach brothers.
Oh, right.
Not nice. A laugh between them. Not one laugh.
Well, that's because neither of them are funny.
Well, John Lithgow is pretty funny, and Buckaroo Banzai.
Yeah. You can't play the Buckaroo Banzai card all the time.
I will play
and
it
you can...
every time I can. In fact, you know what? There was a quote. There was a Buckaroo Banzai quote used in a movie that I saw just recently. Wherever you go, there you are. Somebody used that in a movie, and I can't remember what it was. It was something I just saw recently.
I think it was just in your head, man. I think you just
nope.
play movies in your mind when
so,
you get bored.
So that's the big trivia question. Anybody out there listening to this podcast, if you saw a movie recently that said, wherever you go, there you are, what movie was it? Because I just saw it too, and I can't remember because my brain cells are leaving me.
Mm-hmm. You need to get on those blue pills.
Yeah, I need I need the one that makes you taller.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's it. That's it for us this week. We're gonna go. There's not a lot to see, and next week doesn't look like it's gonna be much better. But we'll be back regardless.